Welcome, welcome, guys. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In. I am joined, as usual, by the hardest working man in poker. Is that what I call you this week, Darragh O'Kearney?
Thanks you for that, David. Yeah, I was looking forward to day off, and it turns out we're actually doing a lock-in. So, yeah.
I spotted that in your social media. You were like, oh, I'm definitely going to take a day off this day. And I thought, oh, that'd be perfect for the lock-in. Let's just on them. We are also joined by a former guest of The Chip Race. He is a mindset coach and author, best known in poker circles, I guess, for his best-selling books, The Mental Game of Poker 1 and 2, co-authored by Darragh's co-author, Barry Carter. He has just released a new book, The Mental Game of Trading. We're going to talk about that later on. He is Jared Tendler. Jared, welcome.
Hey, boys. How are you? Good to see you.
It's great to have you on, Jared. I do want to talk about your new course, which is separate, of course, from your new book. We will do both in just a moment. But I'm going to start by talking about the Unibet US and Unibet Open, as it's how we sort of keep the lights on around here. Another Unibet US has come and gone, Darragh. You fought valiantly in this one, it must be said, after 3 weeks of slogging it out in the W Coupe and World Series of Poker Online streets, you hopped straight into the US's. How did it finish for you in the end?
Oh, I really should know. I went into the last day at third, I think, in the overall leaderboard, and I was all excited. And then when I busted the last one, I just completely lost interest because I knew I wasn't going to win.
Somewhere between fourth and sixth, then probably is where Darragh finished.
Probably fifth, I would say, because okay. I kind of dropped back. I had prospects, particularly in the mid leaderboard. I was actually leading that at different points, and that was also my last shot and bust, very disappointingly, just outside the points. So that was kind of the end of that.
Did you ask for help there? I heard your computer going off. Is somebody trying to prompt you with the answer of where you came in the leaderboard?
I did that thing of where you open your laptop and you get the last 500 notifications. This is a particularly bad day to be opening new devices because, as I'm sure we'll talk about later, we just released the book and there's lots of notifications.
Look at it. The thin brag. Oh, yeah, maybe I will bring up the book at some point, Darragh, much later on in the show. Jared, you must get a decent number of people coming to you before or during the big online series. How does your advice change when it's an online grind like the one Darragh just did rather than the live grind of, say, World Series of Poker?
I mean, it doesn't really. I mean, every player has kind of their own unique set of issues and things they've got to work on before that tournament series. And when I work with players for years, we talk about kind of different stuff before every tournament series. But, you know, there are kind of always a few topics that are important to them. But yeah, I don't think there's necessarily like a big difference between the live and online stuff, except for maybe, you know, establishing a better kind of routine in a place that's not their house, right? Not their home, staying at particular hotels or at a house that's near a gym so they can set themselves up lifestyle wise. Besides that, the mental and emotional demands are kind of unique to them. And we got to figure out what they are.
Very good. Well, there is one fun promotion in which you, me, and Ian are involved. In fact, it might, by the time this show goes out, be already done and dusted. We'll be playing heads up against the winners of the low, medium, and high leaderboards. Unfortunately, I don't get to play against you heads up later. That would have been good fun if you, as the winner, would have got to play me, the ambassador. I don't know what I would have done there. I don't want to be spoiler in that situation. I'm glad that didn't happen now for that reason. We be playing it seriously? Yes, we will, because we're not just spoilers. If we win, we get to keep the money and give it to our community. So it's basically a win for everybody else. But I thought that was a nice little extra bonus Unibet gave to the players who won their leaderboard. So fair play on that. Finally, on this topic, the US culminated, as it is one to do in the last 18 months, with the Unibet Open. No deep finishes, unfortunately, for you or I or Ian or any ambassadors on this time around. But we've actually had a decent run of it the last few. So I guess we were maybe due a bad one. There were a couple of cool stories, though, I want to mention. The first is a player named Jasper playing under the name Psycho76. He played our special chip race tourney at the start of the festival. He KO'd our good friend Alex O'Brien. That earned him a seat in our special sit and go. He won the sit and go, which gave him a Unibet Open ticket. And then he parlayed the Unibet Open ticket to a 24th place finish for €2,500. Congratulations to him. That was a great little bit of a spin up. also what we hoped would be the really big story, and it was brewing, you know, in the later stages of the tournament, was our good pal Smidge Porrick O'Neill, who was at 1.3 of 12. He made the final table. He, of course, won back-to-back Unibet Opens in the last year. We were getting very excited that he might complete an extraordinary hat-trick. In the end, he ran his jacks into aces to come ninth for €4,500. The eventual winner, whose identity we don't know because Unibet do protect anonymity, unless, of course, Leaky Lappin knows who you are and then tells the world anyway on social media, is a player called 4i1a5. He won $55,000. Not a bad weekend's work. Dara, how was your experience of sort of the latter stages of your 5-week grind? Was it just sort of like, oh, I can nearly see the finishing line?
Yeah, it was very much that. It gets easier near the end. I think it's the same in anything. Like, I remember when I run the really long races, the middle part is the difficult part. When you get near the end, you think, well, it's nearly over now. I can definitely get through this. I feel it's kind of the same, that 5-week period where I was playing every day. As you get towards the end, you think, well, it's only 6 more days, 5 more days, 4 more days, etc. And you sort of get a second burst of energy. I could definitely have done with talking to Jared at some point about this. I did start off with all sorts of great routines, and by the end it was just all gone out the window. I wasn't even running anymore. I was just getting up, forcing food into my mouth and turning my computer on and starting to play. It was not a pretty sight, but
all you could do to survive.
Yeah.
It probably does get to that point, Jared, though, where, you know, you do give your best advice, and I'm sure you set people up with pretty good schedules and routines and regimens and whatever. But maybe, like, getting into the latter stages, there is a case of, like, that they're just working on fumes. They're just maybe living off adrenaline. And at that point, maybe you just go, just get what you can from whatever's left in the tank.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of it is trying to avoid getting that to that point, but I think if you're playing in a long series or playing as much as Dara is describing, like, you're going to hit that point. And so, you know, what's the minimum stuff that you can do so that you can play maybe a little bit better? You know, we may be kind of teasing hairs here, but I feel like there's always something you can do, right? It's easy to just say kind of F it and, you know, let all that stuff kind of go on the wayside, thinking that it kind of burns more energy than it actually might actually help produce more of it. But yeah, like you said, we make all these plans ahead of time, but then, as Mike Tyson says, right, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. So, you know, poker's going to punch you in the face, and, you know, then you get to kind of see how well you're able to sustain yourself and do the things that you know are actually kind of in your best interest that, you know, are hard to do if you don't have that routine kind of well established.
Well, this is segueing nicely to the next section I want to talk about. 2 weeks ago, Jared, you announced a brand new video course, the Mental Game Tune-Up for Poker, or for Tournament Poker. In the tweet about it, you said it's designed to take you through the same tools and strategies your clients rely on to prepare for a big series like the WSOP. In broad strokes, what are those tools and strategies?
I mean, there's 8 modules, right? So we're talking about goal setting. And I know that sounds kind of lame, you know, to say right out of the gate, but you know, there's 2 coaching sessions with Matt Affleck and Diego Ventura, who are both, you know, seasoned players, you guys know. And my sessions with them are both 40 minutes long. So goal setting seems like something that's pretty trivial, but it's actually really, really important to kind of set the trajectory of the entire series. It basically kind of guarantees that you'll make progress, because if you set good quality goals that include a lot of that kind of how you're going to accomplish maybe winning a bracelet or winning some titles or making a certain amount of money, then you kind of guarantee that progress is going to be had no matter what the results are, because we know we can't control all that. So goal setting kind of out of the gate. Then there's a module on knowing your game, which I think is, again, one of these things that players kind of have like an idea of where their game is when they go into a series, but they don't firmly understand where their big weaknesses are. They don't firmly understand kind of what the big mistakes that they're going to tend to make. And then we get into, you know, handling tilt and other emotional problems, avoiding burnout, trying to get in the zone more often, improving focus, handling pressure, and improving decision-making. So those are kind of the 8 modules. And, you know, it's kind of like a choose your own adventure, you know, within what we prepare, as I said before, like before every tournament series. So the course is kind of designed to be this thing that you do as like a tune-up before every tournament series you play, right? You kind of, you know, I'd say ideally just, you know, watch through, you know, the 3.5 hours of concept videos. And for me, there's another 8.5 hours of coaching material of me actually like coaching Matt and Diego through each of those modules. So I'd say like try to get through as much of the content once, but then, you know, series over series, or even kind of month over month, however you want to kind of look at your schedule. You know, if you're a cash game player, it can apply in that regard, or quarterly, right? Pick and choose the topics that are most important for you to improve on, right? You can't do all eight things before every tournament series. It's just too much, right? But, you know, sometimes maybe avoiding burnout is more important than handling pressure, right? Otherwise, at other times, it might be, you know, the other way around. So it's really kind of designed to be that thing that mirrors what I do with clients before, you know, several weeks before they go play in the WSOP or before they play WCUP, et cetera. And it kind of gives them it, you know, access to it at any time and as frequently as they want without having to pay me every time.
You mentioned there controlling tilt and other emotions. And actually that strikes me. You also said at the start how maybe online and live are quite similar, but that strikes me as one where maybe there's some difference. Dara, maybe you can speak to this as well, because if you get tilty because of a couple of bad beats on your screen full of games, there's loads of games right in front of you and loads of decisions popping up every few seconds that you still have to sort of stay even keeled and make. Whereas if you do, you know, take a really bad beat, yes, okay, sometimes it doesn't bust you, but a lot of the time it will bust you. And then at least you can go take a shower, take a walk before you jump straight into another one. So there's a natural maybe punctuation when dealing with maybe extremes of tilt in a live setting that don't exist for the online player who has to just sort of keep going and grind through it.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference between online and live. To be honest, I've never really struggled with tilt online. I'm not exactly sure why that is, but I do think there's a couple of things. First of all, when you're playing live, there's a greater emotional investment anyway. You've traveled to the place to play this one tournament. It takes longer. You're physically there, et cetera, et cetera. So it does kind of feel worse when you bust that than say, you know, you bust one of the 12 tournaments on your screen and you just look over to the lobby and decide what you're going to replace it with. Obviously, if it's a really big online tournament, it's slightly different, I guess. It feels more like a live event. But I mean, you know, there's a couple of things I do online. For example, once I'm all in, I don't bother looking at that table anymore. You know, my decision is made. And if I bust the tournament, I look back and the table is gone. I just go up and find a new one. You know, I don't know whether my kings ran into aces or they got busted by twos. It really doesn't matter anyway. The other thing I think as well is just, you know, there's just the sheer volume you play online. It's kind of like no one tournament really matters too much anyway, which can be a danger as well too. Like you can feel that you can probably the bigger danger online is that you just don't take it seriously enough. And a lot of the people I coach actually who are very good players and, you know, play very well live and don't do well online, that does seem to be the issue. It just feels like a video game to them and they're not giving it the same seriousness. Particularly if, you know, if you're down to your last one and it's not a particularly big game and, you know, your Sunday's gone badly, very hard to get too excited about the mini wrap up when you're 27 of 29. But, you know, as a professional, you kind of have to just grind through that. But online, yeah, but live, yeah, definitely. Like I used to say, I never tilt in game, but I definitely tilt after game. You know, I stand up and I'm extremely angry, and you know this well, David. You've learned.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Dara. I'm sure I've never seen this.
You've learned to avoid me for that 12 minute period it takes to clear my head. The only time I ever really worry about that is when there's a danger somebody's going to interview me immediately afterwards, because I'm a pretty terrible, horrible, childish person in those 12 minutes, and really shouldn't. Nobody should interact with me.
I mean, you're probably able to handle tilt really well because your mind is so mathematically oriented and you know the game so well, so that it's easy to kind of handle the ups and downs. You know what players, I mean, there's not a lot of, I don't see a lot of revenge tilt coming out for you, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I think the difference between, you know, for some of the players too, you know, between live and online, sometimes it's actually, you know, it's easier for some of the players live because they have more time to kind of think about the bad beat, process it through, talk about it for themselves or kind of talk themselves through it. Whereas, you know, online, if they make a mistake, they get sucked out, you know, those things kind of tend to stick in their mind more because they actually don't have time to actually, you know, kind of think through it. So it can kind of go either way. I think some players feel more pressure when they're playing live for some of the reasons there are mentioned, or because, right, the stakes are bigger versus when they're playing online. They may, you know, their, you know, ABI may be only $100, but they're used to playing $1,000 live, but the $1,000 kind of means more to them. you know, online, they may be playing up against bigger players, bigger name players. So they're kind of used to, or they're not used to playing up against, you know, people that are going to put them into a lot of uncomfortable spots. Right. And so the pressure may be more live, more online. I think it's really, it can go in either direction.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. And like, it can go bad very quickly online. Like, you know, you can be having a good Sunday. You've loads of stacks everywhere. You've got six legit shots, and then suddenly in a 5 minute period, they're all gone. And that can definitely feel like you've just been punched in the face repeatedly. I guess the other thing is, like, live as well, there's a certain such as social imperative not to make an idiot of yourself. You can't really stand up and scream. Well, I guess you can, and David often does.
People do.
Whoa.
No, actually, David is worse online, in my experience.
Yeah, wait, I was going
to
say.
You scream and swear at the screen, but you can usually manage to maintain some level of decorum live, which is what I'm getting at. There is a sort of a social pressure, let's say, not to overreact to adversity.
Yeah,
it's not unlike the trolls online who are, you know, perfectly willing to spew, but they would never say those things to somebody in person.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
Jared, another aspect of this tune-up is getting into the zone. I suppose some people call it like flow state these days. I'm, as we've discussed on the show before, I'm probably of the more skeptical nature, not that I don't see value in what you and other mindset people do, but I've always sort of, maybe it's just not so much for me, or maybe, you know, I just do getting my head around some of this more ephemeral stuff tough. Can you define flow state, or, you know, in the zone, or however you like to put it best, and maybe give me something a bit more concrete to grab onto?
Yeah. I mean, I think when you're in the zone, I don't love the word flow state because it comes from a term that has more to do with personal psychology rather than performance. So the guy, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, I will not try to spell that for you. He wrote the book Flow, and, you know, talks about more of it being like an enjoyment state, right? Being kind of very present oriented and focused on what's right in front of you. Sense of time is oriented right towards the present. And, you know, there's a huge enjoyment component to it. Whereas for me, I think the zone is more appropriate for performance states because there's actually like outcomes that matter. I don't care if you're in flow and playing like garbage. Like, that's not what we're after here. Just because you're having a ton of fun playing poker, if you're doing that really poorly, that's not, you know, that's not my domain. So for me, the zone is when your mind is functioning at its highest level. And specifically, you are able to access intuition, right? Which means that you're picking up on details of the action, nuances of certain tells or tendencies of your opponents, you know, some adjustments or creative lines that you might take that you don't have full logical rationale for in that moment, but you know is correct, or at least, you know, has a higher likelihood of being correct. If you're tapping into that intuition, and that's, I say that specifically again, because it's different from instinct. There's a huge difference between instinct and intuition. Instinct is like your base level bit of knowledge, right? It's all the stuff that's kind of so well known to you, it's like the back of your hand. Intuition is so brand new, you can't even explain it yet. So when you're tapping into intuition, it means that you're in the zone. And if you're in the zone and you're tapping into intuition, you're playing at the highest level that is possible for you. So how do we conceptualize it? I mean, it's you performing at your absolute best, able to make decisions and reads that you wouldn't normally. How do you get there? That's the challenging part, because it requires a mind that is like has the right amount of energy, right? You can't have your energy be too high, right? You can't be too emotional. You can't be too jacked up. You can't be too fired up or excited. You also can't be too low, right? Where you're a little bit bored and disinterested, right? Everybody kind of has their version of Goldilocks, right? That right amount of energy. And then you need a mind that is clear enough, right? And able to kind of absorb the details of the action in a way that's, you know, very tangible and real. What happens to a lot of people, right? You know, as they're trying to attempt to distract me out of my flow here, out of my zone.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, you can try to, but you're not going to. And so, you know, the clarity is a really important thing. And so what happens for a lot of players, right? They've got too many things on their mind. There's too many things they're working on in their game, and they're trying to kind of force elements of you know, their decision-making, or they've got new ranges, or, you know, new simulations that they want to now be applying. you know, the mind has a limited capacity for how much it can consider at one time. So we kind of clatter ourselves with too much of that stuff. You know, the tilty induced things can get in our way. We can be distracted by, you know, the crypto prices or, you know, other thing going on social media, right? And so all that stuff creates noise, which limits your ability to kind of have a pure reaction to what's going on in the game and make poker more like a sport, right? When we look at and see athletes performing at an incredibly high level, right? You know, football players on the pitch, right? Making plays and moves that you're like, that you're amazed by, right? They are, in a sense, in the zone, having high level reactions that are very, very intuitive and creative into that moment. That's not pre-planned. They can never pre-plan. It would never come out as smooth like that, but they have a shit ton of training for all of their competencies that allows them to be that innovative on the spot. And so when you're in the zone, you're capable of doing that. So I'll gauge my answer here. How well did I do in, you know, convincing you that there's some, you know, practicality here?
I don't know if it was you or the fact that Albert Einstein is standing over your shoulder with the sort of approval look of a dad who really agrees with it. But it worked out. Just all of those things in combination definitely worked. Your
it's
words.
It's definitely him. He's, you know, I use all the subliminal tricks I can use.
Well, look, that sort of brings us nicely to the next little bit of stuff. Dara, you wrote an article for our friends at Gambling Online entitled The Top 5 Tips for Boosting Your Bankroll. And I suppose some of this stuff is sort of overlapping here. I suppose, let's go this way. Let me do this. One of those top tips was the phrase wise up and study common spots. That actually reminds me of a few interviews we've done recently because this has come up a little bit. Can you elaborate on that, Dara?
Yeah, when I was thinking about bankroll management, I mean, the same pieces of advice tend to get recycled endlessly. Is, you know, game selection, play within your bankroll, have certain number of buy-ins, etc. So I was trying to think of things that people typically neglect. And one of the things I think people typically neglect is their skill edge. The higher your skill edge, the lower the swings you will have, and the less you have to worry about bankroll. And this was something which was abundantly clear to us in the beginning when we all had massive edges online and we never really worried about downswings or because our skill edge was so big. And I think when people not only do people neglect that, but, you know, again, even the way that they approach, say, studying isn't to optimize their ROI or to minimize their downswings as a player. It's sort of spots that they find interesting. You know, they had a really difficult river spot, which they didn't know what to do. And they send it to me and you and five other players they know, and they poll all our opinions. And almost invariably, when people send me these spots, first of all, I'm not sure whether they should have called or folded the river. And secondly, when I run it, the solver says, call 46% of the time, fold 54% of the time, which means it actually doesn't matter. It makes no difference in the long run which of those two things they did. And it makes zero difference to their long-term EV or ROI, which of those two things they actually did. It's a very rare spot. It'll probably never come up again. So it has very limited impact in that sense. And it also really doesn't matter what you did. And that's why when, you know, they'll ask seven players and I'll say call, or I'll say fold and you'll say call, and they'll go like, oh, I don't know who to believe now. And it's because those spots really make no difference at all long-term. They're so rare and they make so little difference in terms of what you did. So, but there are common spots where you make the same mistakes over and over and over again. You know, maybe you c-bet too much. Maybe you don't defend the correct ranges from the blinds. Maybe your ranges are off in general. And these are, you know, you're dealt a hand every single hand. And if you're making preflop mistakes, they're just going to compound over time. So that's one area where people definitely don't study enough, their preflop ranges. And there's a lot of really good tools out there now, like Range Trainer Pro, for example, where you can study that stuff. It's boring. You're looking at charts. You're trying to remember what the difference between the hijack and the lowjack is and stuff. But that'll make a huge difference to your overall game long term. Another thing is ICM. You know, a small mistake late on in a tournament could cost you 20 or 30 buy-ins. That's far more important than check raising with the correct frequency on flops when everybody has 100 big blinds. And if your frequency is a little bit off, you're giving off 0.1 big blinds per 100, which when everybody's 100 big blinds means 0.1% of your buy-in. So like focus on the spots that actually make a difference. And they do tend to be unfortunately boring spots. And that's why people, I think, spend not enough time on them. But those are, you know, you've used this phrase a lot too, the bread and butter spots. They are the bread and butter spots. That they're the spots that really make the difference long-term.
Absolutely. Jared, I'm guessing this is an area you work with people a decent amount too. We interviewed Slayer V1 fan, probably the most voluminous poker player of all time. He knows swings better than anyone else, and he also knows how to study spots better than anyone else. And he spends a lot of time on the really boring ones, like Dara said, because pretty much his entire game is based around short stack play. Players probably do get too much into the weeds, and you can probably help them see the wood from the trees. Can you talk about those type of people, maybe players who lose perspective easily? How can you help them?
I mean, a lot of times they're dealing with fantasies, right? They want money to be easy. They want the game to be easy. They don't want to have to work that hard. So, you know, poker is going to, you know, kind of slap you upside the head a few times. Question is, do you get the message? And for a lot of players, the answer is no, because they're going to keep kind of banging their head up against the wall, convinced that their approach is right. And that it's, you know, eventually just going to happen, right? It's very, like, one of the most difficult things in the mental game is to identify those wishes or those illusions that we have about ourselves, about the game, that, you know, affect us. And so how do we find them? A lot of times it's, you know, finding the frustration points, right? Finding the spots where we lose confidence or overconfidence. Like, emotion can be the big signal for that stuff. But, you know, there's a lot of players that are so convicted that their way is right, that they don't want help. They don't even think that they need it. And so, yeah, they're just going to continue to circle the waters. And, you know, I'm not to say, that's not to say that their approach is bad, but it's certainly going to limit their upside.
It's interesting. Dara, we did an interview with Sven McDermott, top Irish player, just a few days ago. It'll be out in the next episode of The Chip Race, something to look forward to for people. In that episode, or in that interview, if you like, we talked with him about free poker resources available today to help maybe lower the barrier of entry for players who are maybe making their way in the game, starting off in the last few years. Obviously, something he's done, a journey he's been on. Your fifth tip in this article for Gamble Online talks about that too. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, like, people sometimes ask me how much easier was it back when you guys started, you know, and it was easier in the sense that everybody was terrible and you just had to be slightly better than terrible to do pretty well. But in some ways it was more difficult because you had to learn everything yourself. Most of the books were terrible. There were no training videos at the time. There were no solvers. The only way people really learned was by doing and by talking to other people who were doing, and hopefully those people were doing things somewhat properly, and you didn't all just get bad together. Nowadays, there's just so much content out there that I liken it to more like going to college and studying. And if anybody puts in the effort, they can get good very, very fast. I mean, I've seen students of mine who literally start from almost zero, and 3 months later, they're crushers. And that's because they get up every day and they just consume hour after hour after hour of good quality content. Most of which is free. Like, there's a lot of stuff out there on YouTube. A lot of the apps like DTO, for example, will give you a free trial. And there's a lot of stuff that you can get your hands on very, very quickly and just get very good at without having to sort of put in a million hands and learn by trial and error. So I think that's another area. Like, people just have to kind of realize that the time of just sort of, in inverted commas, natural talent, where we really weren't that talented. We were just slightly better than terrible, are gone. And now you have to actually put in the work and you have to study. And there's a lot of absolutely wonderful content on YouTube in particular. Now, you have to study the right content. There's a lot of really bad content as well, which will send your game backwards. So a lot of it is just navigating the good stuff. And then, you know, you mentioned Sven. I've watched a few of Sven's Twitch streams. Sven's Twitch streams are an absolute mine of information, because you're watching a high quality player explaining his thought process in real time. And in many ways, that's better than a sort of an edited video where a guy is deciding afterwards, oh, well, this worked out. So this must have been a good play. Sven is often expressing, doubt or I'm not sure what I should do here. And then he talks to his process and he comes to a decision. And that's sort of the way we all experience the game when we're actually playing. So a lot of really high quality Twitch streamers as well. And that's one of the areas which we've seen most of the change. If you think back 3 to 4 years ago, the top Twitchers were all entertainers and they weren't really very good at poker. Now, ironically, a lot of them are still the top Twitch streamers, but in the meantime, they have got very good at poker. I'm thinking of guys like Spraggy, Fenton, Kevin Martin. All of these guys are now top quality players. So you can actually learn a lot just by watching them play. And that's, you know, that's free every night.
One thing that's kind of gotten more important too, from my standpoint, is, you know, the mental game of learning is even more important. So you were kind of alluding to this earlier, David, right? If you have flawed views of yourself in engaging in a learning process, I mean, there's research that has shown overconfidence means that you will learn less than somebody who has a more accurate self-assessment. So, you know, the mental game for me was mostly around performance for a long time. And I knew obviously that, you know, it affected learning, and that learning and flaws in how you approach learning affected, you know, your mental game. But I think what's becoming more and more important for a lot of players too is it's their mental approach to kind of the full circle of what makes them a well-rounded player. And that obviously includes their approach to learning.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. The next story is sort of a fun one. I included it because it is a bit of fun, to be honest. Daniel Jungleman Cates is the latest Elite Pro to join Run It Once's star-studded training site roster, and he announced his arrival with a spectacularly good video, an homage, if you like, to Patrick Bateman's American Psycho, featuring him in his underpants, wearing a face mask, and generally musing on how he likes to murder people, figuratively. Dara, Jungleman is a completely unique character, obviously, in poker. We had him on the show twice, once for an interview and once for an excellent strategy segment, which unsurprisingly is our biggest strategy segment ever on YouTube, available on this channel. This time he's obviously, you know, really kind of going for it. I think he's been to like acting school and he's, you know, he sort of feels comfortable enough to, like, you know, put on a great performance. But he gave us a bit of a performance the time we tried to record an interview with him. We were desperate to get him into a quiet room because that was proving difficult. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, it was very, very difficult. I mean, it was set up by our good friend Warren Lush, who is a great guy to know. And we were obviously thrilled at the prospect of getting Jungleman. And when I finally got him on Skype, let's just say the interaction did not proceed as I expected. he would go through periods where he'd like answer your messages really, really quickly. And you basically had a chat and then you'd ask him something and he'd disappear. And like 4 days later, he'd resume the chat as if it was still ongoing. And then we did finally arrange a time. But even that was quite difficult. I was like, okay, let's do 5 o'clock tomorrow. And he was like, okay, yeah, 5 o'clock's good. And then actually, no, maybe 5:15 is better. What do you think? And I was like, well, it's up to you, really. We're going to do any time you want. And then he's like, maybe 4:45. And this went on for quite a while. We were trying to work out the exact time. And I was just like, just pick a time, Daniel, and we will go with that time, whatever it is. We finally get him at the appointed time. And it sounded like he was at an opera or something. There was a very large lady singing right behind him, which it really sounded like. And we were like, this isn't going to work, Daniel. You are going to have to get somewhere quieter. And he was like, oh, okay. Right. Okay. Well, okay. I'm going to hang up and ring me back in 17 minutes. I remember it was like really specific 17 minutes. It was like, he clearly worked out where he was going to go and that it was going to take him exactly 17 minutes to get there. So I had to ring him back because this was another thing. We had a long discussion about it. And he was like, can you ring me? I don't want to ring you because I don't want to use my data. And I was like, yeah, that's fine. we don't want to use your, I mean, you're apparently up 20 million from poker, but I guess you're watching the pennies on that stuff. So we eventually did get him. We could still hear the kind of singing lady off way off in the background, but it was quieter, let's say. And then he has a very unique method of expression, which I'm sure you as the editor really struggle with, which is where you ask him a question, he's sort of like, throws out all the aspects of stuff that he might want to answer onto the lawn, kind of at random. just like this point, that point. They're all seemingly unrelated. And then he sort of gradually circles into the to the key points. And then he gives a very succinct and brilliant answer, obviously. And then he re-summarizes that at the end, having sort of decided, yeah, this is the answer. So I think you just cut out all of the first 12 minutes of everything he said. But the process was fascinating to watch, how a brilliant mind sort of assembles all the information sort of without judgment. It's almost like watching a person brainstorming with themselves. And then finally finding the correct answer and coming up with like absolutely brilliant answers. There's no doubt, like, he's an absolutely brilliant mind in poker. But the process was quite interesting to observe.
Yeah, it sure was. It was a fun one. Speaking of homages, you know, obviously he did his American Psycho homage, or maybe that's going to get me into trouble just for segueing in that way. I read an article last week entitled "Poker Paint Enters the Weird and Wonderful World of NFTs." It was about the poker art brand Poker Paint, who were entering the potentially lucrative NFT space. Obviously, there's been a lot of Ether rocks and punks and whatnot going around the place. The man behind the company, Brett Butts, actually reached out to me and asked if I would write about it, and I said I would. I will admit that I fully assumed, given the visibility of Poker Paint on social media and the fact that quite a few poker players I know had bought his work, that things were kosher vis-a-vis intellectual property, copyright, what have you. Turns out that they weren't. And on hearing about the NFT launch of 125 images on the crypto collectibles marketplace OpenSea, a number of photographers spoke up about how Butts had used photos they had taken as the basis of his compositions without asking for any permissions, as the, or even just like checking out the chain of ownership, because a lot of the time these photographers wouldn't actually own their own work. It's sometimes a deal where the photographer will, you know, agree to work for the site or the affiliate or the tour, and then they'll own it. So it's actually them who could come, you know, knocking on his door. But, you know, apparently he had done none of that stuff. I spoke directly then, I started getting inundated with DMs from people going, why are you giving this guy a platform? Why are you being nice about his art or whatever? One of these people is a great friend of ours, Dara. I spoke directly to Danny Maxwell, who was very upset at having his work repurposed, shall we say, for profit like this. Christian Zetcha was also dismayed by this. He's a photographer too. Brett Harrington took to Twitter and said, imagine being a photographer and having someone skin your photo and sell it as their art. This was followed up by a chap called Eric Harkins, who replied, I've asked nicely for a cease and desist. If he doesn't, then I'm sure it'll be easy to get the lawyers on this. I was forgiving to a point, but this NFT offer is way over the line. Now, I did a little bit of research, I must say, on this type of artwork, one that sort of uses images created by other people. Fair use suggests that an image must be 30% changed. To be honest, I haven't the foggiest notion how you would quantify that in this case. We've obviously, Dara, had our channel penalized by copyright claims by Poker Central in the past. And to be honest, I think those claims should not be upheld if we had had the appetite to go up against them, which we didn't. Fair use allows footage to be used in an educational capacity, which I would say our coaching videos definitely are. I would also say that we change away more than 30%. Again, I'm not quite sure how you'd work that out, but we are talking about short clips in an otherwise 15-minute video analyzing a specific spot. And again, it's all about the individual hand. It's not about their footage or gaining any advantage from showing that footage. And it is presented in a completely different context. What would you say, Jared, about what Poker Paint has done? And do you have any maybe relatable experience? Obviously, you are the producer of material. Maybe you know a bit about copyright law.
I have a pretty good lawyer that I work with. Yes. I mean, as far as Poker Paint goes, I mean, I saw his reply clearly. Yeah, I thought it was a very contrite recognition of mistakes that were made and lack of knowledge, which I think is pretty ripe across the internet. I mean, you know, Barry Carter and I have talked about this for years. People just assume because it's on the internet, it should be free. And there are certain expectations to that effect. And so, you know, just kind of ripping off content is just the norm for a lot of people. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, kind of growing up in that environment where, you know, memes are created and you know, you'd see YouTube videos made with other content. So it just, the kind of recycling of material just seems to be the norm. You know, I've had the Mentally Gamble Poker 1 and 2, you know, kind of ripped off in Russian and Chinese. I mean, those were sort of standard. I wasn't going to go after, you know, for obvious reasons. And I don't quite have the resources to do that. But I did have somebody in the US who said that he wanted to produce a book that would be a summary of the Mentally Gamble Poker and sell it. He wanted my blessing for him to do this. So he was nice enough at least to email me, you know, this question. And I had my lawyer write up 4 very compelling points. I certainly can pull it up if you're interested to read it. I thought it was very well worded, and never heard from him again. I've had former clients of mine who want to produce material based off of our sessions, of you know, their attempts now to become a mental game coach, kind of using my material as, you know, the basis of their work. You know, there's been lots of videos that have been produced around the mental game. Some use you know, the material and they reference it, which is cool. Others don't, and they think it's theirs. I can't keep track of all of it. I'm kind of happy with my lot in life. I'm focused on my own work. You know, I pick my battles where I can, and, you know, there's just only so much you can do.
Well, Dar, turning to you, how litigious can and should people get over what this guy, Brett Butz, has done? You know, I would sort of argue that depending on maybe the nature of the process in which he engages to create these, I think that's probably paramount to actually judging this one. But you know, you've seen the pictures, obviously, and I'm sure you recognize the photographic originals, if you want to call them that. What do you think?
Yeah, there's a couple of points I would make on this. First of all, this is something which comes up time and time again in art. And, you know, in different art forms, it's almost like they come to different conclusions. When somebody writes a book, it's, you know, a novel, it's generally accepted that they own the copyright to that and you can't just print it off and sell it without paying them. And that's kind of accepted. You know, music came to a similar situation. Even if somebody else writes a song, even if you sing your own version, you still have to pay them royalties. It does kind of come down to money, I think. It kind of depends on how much money they're making. That's when sort of people get interested. If it's, you know, I read Kat Arensby's excellent blog on this too, and she made the point that, like, if it's just some lad clowning around and putting it up on Facebook and getting 20 likes, then nobody's going to care too much. But when somebody's actually making serious money from it, then sort of it does become an issue. There is a story which actually springs to mind, which kind of reinforces this point, which is back in the mid 70s, David Bowie, his first American number one was a song called Fame, which he wrote with his guitarist, Carlos Alomar. Now, Carlos used to work for James Brown, the legendary Godfather of Soul. And James, for whatever reason, decided to rip off the song and put out his own version called Shame or something. It was basically a note-for-note copy. And obviously, everybody's going to assume, having heard these two songs, that Fame must be the rip-off. And Carlos's working relationship with James had ended very badly. He'd more or less been fired. So he was like gung-ho to sue James Brown. And Bowie was like, oh, I'm not sure. This isn't a great look, you know, what English white guy suing Black Godfather of Soul. This doesn't really play well. So they kind of argued back and forth. And then Bowie said, look, let's see how his song does. If it's a big hit, then yeah, fine. We're going to have to go after him. But if it flops, there's no point. And the song did flop. So it ended up never going to court. I think that's kind of the point. Like, when if somebody's making a lot of money off other people's work, then people are going to expect it to be kicked back to them. And that's entirely fair. But if it's just, you know, I mean, our ongoing gripe about Poker Central forcing us to pull our videos was that, like, we're not making any money from these videos. We were actually getting them exposure. And we put, you know, we put work into making them different. And we obviously lost that work then when we were forced to take the videos down. Similar for me, like I was sent a piece in Polish once, which seemed to be about me, and a guy, you know, a Polish friend of mine was saying, oh, look, you're even getting stuff in Poland. So I put it to Google Translate and realized it was literally a word for word translation of a piece I'd written, but no credit. It was just like I was mentioned in the piece, but not that I had actually written the original. But I didn't care, because, you know, this is a small random Polish site, and it's good for me presumably to get exposure in Poland. I might sell a few more books there. the guy clearly wasn't making a fortune off it, so I wasn't going to go after him. But if somebody, you know, turned, I don't know how you would even do this, but if they turned one of my strategy books into a Hollywood movie, yeah, then that, now I want to get paid.
Or into an NFT, Dan. That's
or an NFT, actually. Yeah,
it's all about digital.
That's far more. Yeah, if I understood, if I still don't fully understand what an NFT is, so I would definitely have used that example if I did understand what an NFT was.
All I know is all I know is if you had released your book as an NFT, it would be literally worth $1 million right now, and people would be bidding on it on OpenSea. But you didn't. You just went the old-fashioned way through Amazon. Boring. Look, after initially being very defensive about both his process, his art, his integrity, his company, Boots took to Twitter with what I thought was a decent statement. You referred to it there a moment ago, Jared. I'm going to read it. I'm going to have to zoom in a little because it's quite a long article. I only have it on my phone here. I'd like to apologize for not representing myself, my brand, and the poker community in a professional manner. Looking back over my tweets, I realized that I allowed frustration I felt towards a few people taking pot shots at my art to influence my responses to the community at large, and I apologize for doing so. I want to apologize specifically to the content creators whose legitimate concerns I did not acknowledge quickly and respectfully enough. To that end, I want to briefly address the allegations of stealing, in inverted commas. I'm a 25-year-old poker player and artist, and until 48 hours ago, my knowledge of copyright law was essentially non-existent. Or rather, it was my sincere belief based on my extremely limited understanding of copyright that there was nothing wrong with basing a hand-drawn piece of pop art off an original photograph pulled from social media or otherwise freely available on the internet. I was clearly ignorant about copyright laws and got defensive when I was brought to my attention. Now that I've realized to what extent I was wrong, I want to make it right and continue doing business the correct way moving forward. I need to educate myself on the law and make 100% sure that my work and at Poker Paint is not infringing on anyone else's rights. And I want to assure everyone out there that I'm in the process of doing so. Once I confirm with legal counsel with aspects of my business model are and are not compliant in copyright laws, I will do whatever is necessary to make up for past mistakes and make sure Poker Paint's business model going forward is fully compliant with the law. Please understand that this is a steep learning curve for me, but my promise to the community and affected content creators is that I will make right as soon as I possibly can. Here's the kind of interesting bit, because this kind of throws an extra little maybe question mark over the whole thing. In the meantime, I've pulled from my website and social media accounts all the pieces that I receive complaints on. If I have overlooked anything, please let me know and I will take it down immediately. Anyone who knows me knows that Poker Paint is a labor of love, and I hope to continue to bring memories to the poker community for years to come. I promise I will do the right thing in a way that is transparent to the poker community that I love and that I'm so grateful to be a part of. Now, that is a lovely sort of contrite, as you said, Jared, message. And I think he does deserve a lot of credit for probably recognizing his knee-jerk reaction initially. And I think that, you know, he's gone an awful long way. If that was the kind of attitude we were seeing at the very beginning, I think he'd maybe even gone as far as to have photographers and people reach out to him saying, would you be interested in using my work like this? I'm really interested in the kind of, you know, material you're making. Maybe we could make some money together, you know, that kind of thing. KL Cleeton, who owns a poker paint piece himself, gifted to him by Veronica Brill earlier this year, said, this is a solid first step and I can't wait to see everything sorted so you can get back to creating. Former guest of the show, Thomas Keeling, also called it a great start, but he added, you're still doing opt-out rather than opt-in. For example, I know Joe Giron won't approve of you selling his Esfandiari for $600, but instead of taking it down, you're just going to wait for him to complain about it, ? And I suppose that does throw up a kind of maybe one final question on this issue, and we won't kind of belabor it much more than that, which is that, you know, well, one, I don't know, maybe Joe Giron doesn't own that piece. He certainly created it. There's a very good chance he does. I think Giron does own actually most of the work created by his photography company. But shouldn't it be the case that he just takes the whole thing down and then kind of goes piecemeal, step by step, and asks people, can I do this with your work? Jared, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think in theory, that sounds right. I mean, are they easily contactable? It sounds like, I think in hindsight,
they contacted him most of them, yeah. Anyway.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It sounds like they contacted him and he was sort of ignoring their early messages. So, you know, as you were kind of recanting his apology, I was remembering that was kind of part of the equation here. So, yeah, I mean, I think I think if you're going to take the absolute high road, then yeah, you 100% go, you know, opt in and not opt out. you know, there's lines, right? I mean, there's sort of degrees to which you're going to kind of run your business model. And to what extent are they contactable? Or to what extent, as you said, do they own it? To some degree, it's hard. But if it was me, personally, the way that I run my business, it would be 100% opt-in. Not opt-out. I think it's, for me, my business is mostly reputation-based, right? I mean, and so I wouldn't do anything to taint it and have, you know, kind of, I guess we're talking, 15, 16 years now, right? And I kind of always try to do right by my customers and clients. And so that's how I would personally do it. But
yeah, I think we would probably share a similar opinion, Dara.
Yeah, one final point I would say on that stuff is it sounds like maybe Joe's taking his eye off the ball. I don't know if you remember this, or maybe I'm misremembering it, but the only time we've ever had to pull a poster was the first Helmet episode we did. We used one of Joe's photographs of Helmet, and within about 3 minutes of the poster going live, we got a cease and desist from Joe. And when I asked a few people about that, said, oh yeah, Joe is very, very strong about protecting his copyrights, which, you know, is fair enough. I'm just surprised that he's one of the guys who appears to have missed this latest infraction.
Yeah, or he's just gone the legal route and that lad Butts is about to receive
he's doing the boy thing of let's wait and see how much money he makes so we can decide how
Well, look, we'll leave it there, but for more on this, I would highly recommend a couple of excellent pieces, one by Haley Hintze for poker.org entitled Poker Paint Founder Issues Apology but Refrains from Abandoning Business Model, and a stellar piece Dara referred to it there a moment ago, looking at this issue through a wider lens from the brilliant Kat Arnsby. That one is called Poker Paintings, The Inevitable Art Heist, and it can be found on her thepokerbaffer.com blog. Okay, I want to finish with the roundup, but there's going to be a roundup and then there's going to be a real finish, because the real finish is going to be you two. But I'm going to fly through a few stories of the week. WSOB just started in Las Vegas, and it's going to be, I think, a fairly fascinating 7 weeks. Nobody quite knows how it's going to go down and work, and people are presuming some amount of disaster and catastrophe along the way. Obviously, COVID rampant in Las Vegas right now. Only, 58% of the state in Nevada are vaccinated. Now there's about to be, train loads, plane loads of people just landing in there from all walks of life, every country in the world. Or maybe they've all had to do their little, Mickey Mouse quarantine. But it's still going to be a real hodgepodge of people sitting in the room, passing chips around to each other. Barry Carter is convinced that there's going to be chaos, and he has created a bingo card of incidents that he believes will take place. Well worth checking out his pinned tweet, I think it is. I actually think two of the slots have already been filled in from just a prelude to WSOP stuff. Friend of the show, Card Player Lifestyle, is hosting a mixed game festival in the Westgate Hotel and Casino from October 4th to 7th. It will adopt a very unique cash game / tournament hybrid structure, whereby time at the cash game tables over the course of a few days will earn you a bigger stack in the $200 horse main event. No small thing, and credit to whom Robbie Straczynski has secured a platinum pass for the winner of this one. So it should be an exciting few days for those who love lower stakes mixed games. It also sort of indicates that Poker Stars are coming back with the PSPC in some form. One would expect maybe it'll be Barcelona in 2022 in the usual slot. Maybe it'll be at the end of the year. But that's one to watch. Obviously, it's a big moment on the poker calendar. The Triton Million London is now available to watch on YouTube. Episodes 1 and 2 have already dropped, and it's going to be Engrossing Poker TV. The result might be well known, but it's amazing just getting to watch a package show with all these legends of the game playing for £1 million each, trying to win £19 million. Super High Roller Bowl is on right now. In fact, it's actually happening right at this very moment. So this is accurate as to about an hour ago. 19 players entered. They all stumped up 300K. A chap called Daniel Negrán, who was the first out after an optimistic call, shall we say, versus Mike Adamo. Jonathan Little squeaked through day one with the teeny tiniest stack, but at the time of recording, Alex Foxen was leading the charge over Seth Davies in second. More could jump into this one straight into day two, as far as I know. So the field of 10 is probably bigger right now and probably growing. Finally, I'll take a deep breath. Jared and Dara, I want to give you both the chance to tell us about your new books. Jared, you're the guest. You go first.
No. Dara must go first. I can't. Okay, fine. I will. So, yeah.
You recently released The Mental Game of Trading, a system for solving problems with greed, fear, anger, confidence, and discipline. How is the psychology of trading or around trading similar, and how is it different from poker?
Similar in that you're dealing with, you know, incomplete information. You're playing up against, well, I guess different in that in trading, you're playing up against the market for the most part, unless you're, you know, a massive player in the game. And so obviously in poker, you're playing up against, people. So the revenge tilt thing happens in a different form for traders, right? There's a revenge against the market as a whole versus revenge against, a particular player in itself. But the variance as a factor is a very common one. And just in terms of the short-term volatility of your results and the lack of kind of accurate feedback of your performance based on the results that you're getting in the short term are kind of equal in poker and trading. However, trading is more there are more kind of unknown variables that make the game a lot more difficult to kind of get that good feedback. I think the learning curve is a lot steeper to become a good trader than it is to become a good poker player. And in part because of that, right? The feedback that you're going to get is way more, it would be kind of like playing no limit hold'em pre-flop. And then on the flop, you're playing PLO. And then on the turn, you're playing Raz, right? The game in trading can change very rapidly. You don't know if your decisions were actually good, right? You need to have some kind of a system that's established and proven over time. And usually that means learning from seasoned traders who are now kind of opening their playbooks, which is a bigger thing that's happening in the last 3 to 5 years, as you know, poker has been doing for, I think, a bit longer, truthfully, even though there's been trading content out there, the systems that are being kind of sold are much more ubiquitous now than they were years ago. There's a lot of parallels, but at the same time, there's also a lot of parallels with other sports. That's why I was able to move from golf to poker and from poker to trading and to esports. And, you know, I've worked with radiologists and lawyers and salespeople, pool players, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we're all people. And so the things that we're reacting to and the ways in which we struggle, you know, are the same. The environment is what changes, the uniqueness of, you know, the application of certain strategies. You know, greed is a topic that's not really talked about in poker, right? We talk about it in different ways. Fear is, I think, a bigger issue in trading. In terms of it being known as a bigger issue, but fear exists in a very big way in poker, but poker players still kind of put it under the umbrella of tilt, right? So a lot of the books, you know, both The Mental Game of Poker and The Mental Game of Trading, I think have kind of tried to help people to more accurately assess what problems they're actually dealing with, not the problems that they think that they have.
Well, I gotta say, Jared, I made a huge mistake because I knew something that I think probably is quite famous about your books, which is that Mental Game of Poker came out on Black Friday. So when I heard you were doing a Mental Game of Trading, I immediately pulled all my stocks, all my crypto, sold everything, just presumed you were getting in right at the worst moment, and there was no way I should jump on that train anymore.
Yeah, and it turned out it basically came out at the top of the crypto market. So yeah.
Yeah. You've what industry are you going to wreck next?
A good question. I don't know. I feel like salespeople kind of have it coming for them.
Well, obviously, we wish you all the best with that. I haven't read it yet. I will be honest, but I am definitely going to.
It's very good. No, I mean, it's definitely you know, top notch.
Page turner.
Yeah, exactly. I will say one thing just for the poker players. If you haven't read The Mental Game of Poker, don't get The Mental Game of Trading. Right, still stick with the poker book. But if you've gotten it and you want more, right? The system is kind of more systematized. There's more content. It's about 60% longer. So, you know, if you're still struggling, right? There's maybe another option for you.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, there are literally, I want to say like minutes or seconds before this episode began being recorded, you had a very special drop. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, Barry finally got off his ass and we managed to release this book, which we've been promising forever. I was on Rec Poker earlier, and I said this, Barry's clearly somebody who needs a deadline, because most of the pandemic for me has been me going like, I think we'll get the book out next month, and him going, I'm not sure. And then we finally reached the point where it was like, well, the IPO is coming up next month. We're going to have a book signing there. So get the book out. No more excuses. Not only did he get it out well in advance of the IPO, you know, the IPO is still weeks off and the book is out. But like last week, I said to him, I'm going on Rec Poker next Tuesday to announce it. So please get the book out so that I can at least do that. And he got it. He managed to hit that deadline too. So, I mean, I think I've finally worked out how to deal with Barry. But yeah, it's the book is about ICM, I think, as everybody knows at this point. It's the book we definitely put the most work into. You know, the first book was about satellites, which I knew backwards. And it was really just a matter of me doing a brain dump to Barry and getting that book out. The second book was about PKOs, which I was doing a lot of study on at the time anyway, because I was sort of transitioning to them being my main game. This one's about ICM and really the sort of, you know, while ICM has been around forever and, you know, back when you grinded 45 mans, it was vital to all of us who played tournaments. It's kind of come out of fashion in recent years in the sense that people were like, oh, well, everything, you know, I played 9-man sit and goes, you played 45 mans. ICM was very important at that stage in a 2000 runner field. It's not important until you get down to the last 45 or the bubble. So it wasn't seen as a big thing, but I think people have realized in recent years that even a small mistake in ICM can cost you a huge amount. And actually the example of which I'm going to keep using in interviews is from the bigger 55 a few years ago when you were on final table and you were one pip below the calling range. And when we analyzed, we actually found out it was a very, very costly mistake, even though you were only off by one pip. So
getting trashed in this new book too?
Correct.
Okay, you could have got what I could get a warning for this. Jesus Christ, you dragged me through the mud book after book. I should at least get told when I have to prepare my defense.
Trigger warnings.
Yeah, it was I mean, it's, you know, it's an obscure Irish poker player. He doesn't play very much anymore these days. Lave Dappin or something like that. I can't remember his exact name. But I think one of the things we're keen on, because the books are aimed at recreationals, obviously. And one of the key things we're very keen on is having Barry providing value for money. And you know, the first book, it was very easy. If a player reads the book and suddenly they can get into some big events that they want to play a lot cheaper, then obviously the book more than pays for itself. On the second book, it was a similar thing. Like if people are playing PKOs badly and they read the book and now they start taking even one extra bounty, that'll pay for the book. This one is kind of similar. Like the really big mistakes that you see people make are ICM mistakes. And if you can even avoid one of those mistakes deep in a big tournament, the book will pay for itself over and over again. We are very excited about the book because we put a lot of work into it. It's never been done before. And what has really happened in the last couple of years is the solvers have become ICM aware, the post-flop solvers. So any previous discussions of ICM tended to focus just on pre-flop because that was the only thing we could actually check. But we ran thousands and thousands of post-flop simulations. And that doesn't mean there's thousands and thousands of charts in the book. It was just to try and distill what the key concepts were. And that's essentially what we did in the book. So this is the first time this has been tackled, post-flop ICM, which we think is one of the last great unsolved areas. Actually, the quote we got from Daniel Devores that's on the back cover of the book sort of focuses on that. It really is new ground, and I think it will be a game changer. I got a joking message from our old friend Dara Davey saying myself and Barry are killing the game one book at a time. And that's going to continue, Dara. I'm afraid that's kind of what we decided. Barry's very excited about this book. Barry is sort of also the target audience of this book, and he thinks that this is our best book. So I'm getting excited about it as well. Book is out now, available on Amazon. It'll be available on the other places that the other books were available in the next few weeks, probably. That's all Barry stuff. If you want to ask about release dates, please hound Barry on Twitter because he's got nothing to do now that he's finished the book.
Yeah, and I will reiterate there, I did get a sneaky pre-read of the book. And I have to say, I think it is your best book. I think the Satellite Strategy book, Like you said, you knew it inside out, but I probably knew it nearly inside out, and therefore that was a refresher for me. This was game changing for me. This is like huge, you know, amount of information there. Genuinely, you know, mind opening stuff about late game that I think everybody would benefit from. Before we wrap up, I just want to say thank you so much to the pair of you. I didn't mention earlier that if you would like the Mindset Tune-Up, that is available, I want to say, at jaredtendler.com. I don't know if it's available anywhere else. Is it, Jared?
It's not. No, the web, the video course is actually hosted on my website. So yeah, you go to jaredtendler.com. There's a, you know, little link at the top, you know, it says video course, click on that and you can buy it there.
Superb stuff. Well, look, Mental Game of Trading and Endgame Poker Strategy are both available on Amazon. I recommend both, even though I haven't read the trading one, but I'm going to now. I've no doubt that they're both going to be huge sellers. Congratulations to you both. Darragh O'Kearney, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. And it was great to have Jared on. Jared and I are, I guess you call us Eskimo brothers of the poker world, since we both...
That's just more disgusting for some reason. I don't know why we have to end on that note. Jared Tendler, I apologize for what Darragh just said. Thank you very much.
It's very well intended in spirit. I know exactly what it means. And that's what makes us brothers. So good stuff. Good to see you guys. Take care. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks a million. Cheers.